Welcome to Hear the Heart, where we want to connect the eternal truth that brings joy with everyday life that desperately needs it. Let's jump in right away with our hosts.
So what if the absolute best thing for your company's bottom line is, you know, actually refusing to fire the employee who just severely breached your trust?
I mean, it sounds completely counterintuitive to, like, modern management logic.
It really does. But I want you, the listener, to sort of place yourself in a scenario that happens, honestly, in corporate spaces every single day.
Right, yeah.
You manage a team, and a colleague messes up. And I am not talking about a minor typo in a client email.
Yeah, or forgetting to mute on a Zoom call.
Exactly. I mean, a really profound, uncomfortable breach of conduct, like a toxic attitude that is just actively poisoning the team's morale, or, you know, chronic insubordination, or maybe a decision that just shatters trust.
No.
But, and here is the crucial friction point, it is not quite a fireable offense.
Right. It occupies that agonizing gray area.
Yes, that gray area. And the modern corporate playbook really only offers a few, frankly, dismal options at this juncture. You drag them into a sterile conference room for an HR dressing down. Or you put them on a performance improvement plan.
Ah, the dreaded PIP.
The PIP, which, let us be intellectually honest here, is rarely about actual improvement.
No, not at all. A PIP is, well, it's almost exclusively a legal mechanism. It's a paper trail meticulously designed to lead an employee to the exit door.
Right, while protecting the company from a wrongful termination lawsuit.
Exactly. It is a countdown timer. I mean, it's not a lifeline.
Or, you know, the company deploys the most insidious option, which is the freeze-out.
Oh, that happens so often.
It does. Management just quietly suffocates the employee. They get bypassed for high-level projects. They're suddenly, like, left off calendar invites.
Yeah, and the culture just isolates them until they, you know, absorb the hint and resign.
Which is cowardly. It drains institutional energy, and it leaves the rest of the team completely demoralized. Because, well, they're watching a human being get slowly discarded.
And that discarding process is literally the default setting for most organizations, which is why the framework we are unpacking today is so disruptive.
Totally. So today on Hear the Heart, we are examining a radical paradigm-shifting alternative to that sterile PIP process.
It's a framework called the Rebuilding Together concept, or RT.
Now, my mission for this deep dive is very specific. Because this program originates from a faith-based educational setting, it is obviously steeped in theological language.
Yeah, it is.
But the underlying mechanics of, like, human psychology, conflict resolution, and organizational health, those are universal. So my goal is to translate these principles. By the end of this conversation, whether you work at a tech startup, a logistics firm, or a hospital, you will understand how to apply this grace-based architecture to your own workplace.
And, you know, that translation is entirely possible because the core philosophy of Rebuilding Together, it really transcends its specific origin. Well, the foundational premise is just restoration over punishment. The RT framework outright refuses to view human capital through a purely utilitarian lens.
Right.
It demands that an organization view its employees through a lens of profound dignity. In this model, a severe mistake isn't an immediate exit ramp. It is treated as a diagnostic flare going up.
Oh, I like that phrasing. A diagnostic flare.
Yeah, it signals a critical opportunity for highly customized, mentored growth.
Okay, I have to pause you there and push back on behalf of, well, every exhausted middle manager listening to this right now.
Fair enough. Go for it.
Because firing someone is hard, yes, but a clean break is often just the easiest path for the organization.
Ooh.
It requires the least amount of emotional bandwidth from leadership.
True.
So why would a company deliberately choose to invest massive amounts of time, resources, and emotional energy into rebuilding someone who just caused a huge operational headache? I mean, right out of the gate, this sounds like a recipe for getting walked all over by manipulative employees. If you lead with grace when someone violates the code of conduct, doesn't that inherently lower the bar?
That is the fear, yeah.
Doesn't it communicate to the rest of the team that, you know, bad behavior is just tolerated?
See, that is the most common critique of grace-based management. But the data and the philosophical framework of RT, they actually argue the exact inverse.
Okay, unpack that for me.
Let's look at the philosophy first. The RT program is explicitly designed for behavioral breaches that violate standards but fall short of immediate termination. Because it was developed in a Christian context, it models itself on the historical accounts of Jesus managing his disciples.
Right.
And if you study those texts as purely like leadership case studies, his followers were a human resources nightmare.
Totally. They were a mess.
Exactly. They struggled with chronic doubt, reckless ambition, petty infighting, catastrophic missteps. But the leadership model wasn't to, you know, terminate their contracts. The model was to utilize their failures as the actual curriculum for their development.
Okay, so my read on that,
yeah,
if we're translating it to a secular boardroom, is that the failure exposes the precise skill gap the employee needs to work on.
Precisely. Now, to address your skepticism about lowering the bar, the RT program does not enable bad behavior because it demands a staggering level of personal accountability.
Yeah, that stood out to me in the source material.
Right. From a strict compliance standpoint, this program is actually a highly documented, rigorous disciplinary practice. It aligns perfectly with best practices for employee retention.
Because we often ignore the hidden economics of firing someone.
Oh, absolutely. The sheer cost of turnover, recruitment, onboarding, and just lost institutional knowledge is astronomical. Rebuilding a flawed employee is often significantly cheaper than hiring a pristine stranger.
And the mechanism for that accountability, which I think completely neutralizes the idea that this is just a soft slap on the wrist, is the intake form.
Yes, the intake form is huge.
The source material details this, and it really caught my attention. The employee doesn't just sit in a chair while HR reads them the Riot Act.
No.
They are required to sign a formal written intake document. They have to explicitly articulate their responsibility in the breach and legally commit to the arduous work of the recovery program. I mean, they have to ask for the help.
And that agency is the psychological linchpin.
Right.
Because if management imposes a recovery plan, it feels like punishment. But if the employee signs a document requesting the recovery plan, it becomes a mutual contract for growth.
It shifts the entire dynamic from us versus them to we are fixing this together.
Exactly. And that heals organizational disillusionment. It signals to the wider staff that their value as a human being is not entirely predicated on their last mistake.
Imagine the psychological safety of operating in that kind of ecosystem. If you, the listener, know that your worst professional stumble triggers a structured support network designed to diagnose why you failed rather than triggering, you know, an ambush meeting to strip you of your health insurance.
Right. Your loyalty to that organization is going to be unbreakable.
Unbreakable. But a beautiful philosophy is useless without a functional engine. My immediate concern reading through the introduction was the potential for chaos.
Sure.
How does a company actually execute a grace-based recovery without it just devolving into a subjective, highly emotional mess?
Well, it requires an ironclad structure, and the RT documentation provides a very strict 8-step roadmap. It removes the subjectivity entirely.
Okay, let's walk through that architecture.
Step 1 is the breach itself. Step 2 requires immediate contact with the designated RT program representative.
Which is important because that removes the direct supervisor from being the sole judge and jury, right?
Exactly. Step 3 involves presenting a tentative roadmap to the supervisor to ensure it aligns with, you know, departmental goals. Step 4 is crucial. The employee is contacted and they select an approved mentor.
An approved mentor, okay.
Step 5 is the creation of a highly personalized growth roadmap. Step 6 is the actual work, completing specific modules with that mentor.
Wow.
Then step 7 is mentor confirmation of progress. And step 8 is a concluding meeting, where the HR file is officially updated to reflect the successful restoration.
Okay, I really want to dissect step 5, the personalized growth roadmap. Because I feel like this is where the PIP model usually fails miserably.
Oh, without a doubt.
A standard PIP is just boilerplate. It's like, improve sales calls by 20% or you're fired. It addresses the symptom, not the root cause.
Yeah.
When I read the RT curriculum, it struck me as the corporate equivalent of an IEP.
An individualized education program.
Yes, like what they use in schools.
That is a brilliant way to frame it, actually.
Because if a student is failing math, an IEP doesn't just say do better at math.
Right.
It requires baseline testing. It identifies if the issue is a learning disability or maybe a hostile home environment or even just a vision problem.
Mm.
And then it prescribes a highly specific customized intervention. The RT curriculum is completely a la carte in the exact same way.
It is. The source lists an attitude check module, which serves as the baseline diagnostic, and that one is mandatory for all participants.
Makes sense.
But from there, it branches out based on the specific pathology of the failure. The nuance of these modules is remarkable.
What kind of modules are we talking about?
They offer interventions for conflict resolution, respectful communication, appropriate attire, substance abuse, chronic tardiness.
Wow, so really specific behavioral issues.
Extremely specific, but they also include highly specific psychological interventions. There is a module titled Healing Church Pain, which in a secular context translates directly to another module they offer, which is Faithful Through Organizational Disillusionment.
See, that specific module is what convinced me this program is absolute genius.
Right.
Think about how much baggage employees carry from previous toxic bosses.
Yeah.
They bring that organizational trauma into your company, and it manifests as like paranoia or passive aggression or just a refusal to collaborate. Recognizing that disillusionment is a behavioral root cause that requires dedicated treatment, rather than just punishing the resulting bad attitude. I mean, that is revolutionary.
It truly treats the employee as a complex historical being, not just a malfunctioning cog in a machine.
So what does the timeline look like for this?
The timeline is adaptable, but the workbook maps out an ideal 8-week flow.
8 weeks?
Yeah. Week one is dedicated entirely to understanding the failure. You cannot fix what you refuse to comprehend.
Right.
Week two shifts to accepting responsibility, which often involves drafting apology letters. Interestingly, these letters aren't always sent.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The exercise is more about taking internal ownership. Then week three focuses on character building. Week four shifts to competency. Week five tackles capacity and stress management.
Which is huge, recognizing that many breaches are simply the result of an employee being overwhelmed.
Exactly. Then week six is reconciliation. Week seven provides ongoing support. And week eight culminates in a conflict resolution workshop and a formal celebration of progress.
A graduation ceremony for HR disciplinary action.
I know.
It sounds absurd until you realize the psychological closure it provides. Okay. But this entire 8-week engine completely collapses without one critical element.
The mentor.
The mentor. The documentation is adamant that the mentor cannot be the employee's direct supervisor.
Right. They aren't a parole officer tracking compliance. They are described as a gracious and encouraging cheerleader and a confidential liaison.
But this introduces a massive logistical problem for a standard company. Internal mentorship is inherently dangerous.
Yeah.
Office politics, gossip, reporting lines. I mean, it makes true vulnerability almost impossible.
Yeah. The RT program actually circumvents the internal politics entirely through a lead letter.
Okay, let's talk about that.
Their director actively drafts letters to trusted community leaders. The letter outlines the RT program, explicitly stating the goal is restoration, not punishment, and formally invites these external leaders to volunteer as mentors for the struggling employee.
Okay, let me stop you, because this is where the secular translation is absolutely vital. I manage a secular marketing firm, for example.
Yeah.
I cannot email an employee's pastor.
Right, you can't.
If an employee breaches conduct, how do I externalize the mentorship without, you know, crossing major professional boundaries?
Well, you apply the exact same psychological mechanism, just with different personnel. The underlying genius of the Dear Pastor letter is the recognition that behavioral change requires a safe, objective, mature perspective outside the blast radius of the workplace failure.
The blast radius. That is such a good term for it.
Right. So in a corporate setting, your letter goes to an external executive coach, or it goes to an industry mentor the employee respects, or even a licensed therapist, potentially subsidized by the company's employee assistance program.
Ah, an EAP. That makes sense.
The goal is to outsource the processing of shame and failure to a professional who has literally no stake in the company's quarterly earnings.
That makes perfect sense. You are giving the employee a truly insulated space. They can confess, hey, I yelled at the vendor because I am terrified of losing my job and my marriage is falling apart, without the paralyzing fear that this vulnerability will be weaponized against them in their next performance review.
Exactly. It separates the healing process from the evaluative process.
So we have the scaffolding, the 8 steps, the customized IEP style modules, the externalized mentors. But what is the actual substance of the curriculum? What are they learning in these 8 weeks?
Let's dive into it.
I want to guide us into what the text identifies as the foundational, most universally required module, which is respectful communication.
Oh, this one is deep.
Because most corporate communication training is agonizingly superficial. It is just a list of tactics, like maintain eye contact, use I statements, don't cross your arms.
Yeah, it's very mechanical. The RT curriculum ignores those superficial tactics and targets the philosophical root of human interaction. It builds its entire communication framework on the theological concept of the Imago Dei.
The image of God.
Right. The belief that every person is created in the image of God.
There is a C.S. Lewis quote they feature prominently in the workbook.
Yeah.
That really arrested my attention. Lewis wrote, "There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal."
It gives you chills.
It does. If we strip the specific theology out of that for a corporate context, we're talking about unconditional positive regard.
Right.
If I genuinely internalize the belief that the abrasive project manager I am currently arguing with is not just an obstacle, but a complex entity possessing inherent, immovable dignity, I mean, it fundamentally alters the physics of the conversation.
It changes the weight of your vocabulary. The module actually references Proverbs 18.21, noting that the tongue possesses the power of life and death.
Right.
If you view your colleague as a mere mortal, or worse, as a disposable asset, your communication becomes transactional and often destructive. But if you view them as possessing inherent dignity, every interaction becomes a choice. Am I utilizing my words to construct this person's capacity, or am I dismantling their worth?
The friction point, though, is applying that lofty ideal across severe power dynamics. It is easy to protect someone's dignity when you are peers grabbing coffee.
Oh, absolutely.
It is infinitely harder when you have to challenge the person who signs your paychecks. And the RT module explicitly tackles this through what it calls upward communication.
Yes, navigating authority.
How does this framework instruct an employee to balance necessary, honest confrontation with the realities of corporate hierarchy? Because the usual outcome is either an employee becomes a sycophant out of fear, or they become insubordinate out of frustration.
Well, the curriculum diffuses that tension by forcing the employee to audit their own internal state before they ever utter a single word to their superior. It provides a fascinating diagnostic tool, a checklist of fear.
A checklist of fear.
Yes. It acknowledges that speaking truth to power is biologically terrifying. So before an employee confronts a boss, the mentor has them review this checklist to identify the invisible drivers of their communication.
Let's build a scenario to see how that works.
Yeah.
Let's invent a junior graphic designer. We'll call her Sarah.
Okay, Sarah.
Sarah needs to tell her creative director, who is notoriously defensive, that his new campaign strategy is fundamentally flawed. Now, if she just marches in there, it will be a disaster. How does the checklist intervene here?
So the mentor sits Sarah down and asks her to review the checklist. Sarah might identify, I am afraid of losing my job or being demoted if I insult his idea.
A very valid fear.
Right. Or perhaps she checks, I am afraid of retaliation, that he will ice me out of future projects. Or, in a moment of deep honesty, she might check, I am jealous of his position, and part of me wants to humiliate him to prove I am smarter.
Oh, wow. That level of self-awareness is tough.
It is. But by forcing Sarah to isolate the specific insecurity or toxic motives, the mentor helps her dismantle it. Once Sarah separates her objective critique of the campaign from her subjective fear of retaliation or her own ego, she can construct a message that is impeccably respectful but entirely honest.
She removes the toxic undercurrent that the boss would inevitably react defensively to.
Exactly. It is an emotional filtration system for corporate feedback.
And the curriculum flips that dynamic to examine downward communication too, right? How supervisors speak to subordinates.
Oh, right. The mandate here is that leaders must communicate to build. They use the historical Jesus as the ultimate archetype for leadership development.
And the analysis of his leadership style is highly applicable here. The text points out that Jesus did not merely manage tasks or delegate objectives. He developed his team holistically.
Yeah, the workbook categorizes this development across multiple domains, spiritually, emotionally, intellectually, relationally, physically, and vocationally.
The text asks participants to look at specific historical interactions and map them to those domains. When he recruits the fishermen, he is altering their vocational trajectory.
Right.
When he instructs them on managing anxiety, he is developing them emotionally. The indictment of the modern manager is profound here. Are you merely extracting labor from your subordinates, or are you actively developing their holistic capacity to function in the world?
And a non-negotiable component of that downward development is clarity. The module provides a brilliant maxim. Clarity is kindness.
Clarity is kindness. I love that.
Ambiguity is the enemy of psychological safety. It breeds paranoia and confusion. The source text actually analyzes when and why Jesus used clarity versus ambiguity.
No, that's interesting.
With his core team, his directives were blunt, direct, and unambiguous. The only instances where he utilized intentional ambiguity, such as speaking in complex parables, was with the outside crowds.
Why the difference?
The mechanism there was to force the genuinely curious to press in and do the intellectual labor required to understand, but with his own staff. Absolute transparency.
Which is the polar opposite of how modern executives communicate.
Oh, yeah.
We drown our subordinates in corporate jargon. You know, synergize, pivot, circle back.
Let's take this offline.
Right. Because we are terrified of the emotional friction that comes with direct, clear communication. We use ambiguity as a shield.
We really do.
And speaking of emotional friction, the communication module contains an appendix that I found to be the most practical piece of corporate advice I have ever read.
The termination appendix?
Yes. It covers the do's and don'ts of the most excruciating conversation in business. Firing someone. Even in a program dedicated to restoration, there are instances where termination is unavoidable.
It happens. And the appendix operates as a masterclass in empathy during a crisis. The rules are highly specific. The do's require the manager to approach the situation with explicit compassion. Crucially, it instructs the manager to verbally acknowledge the awkwardness.
Literally saying it out loud.
Literally saying, I know this transition is incredibly uncomfortable for both of us. That simple admission of shared human discomfort instantly de-escalates the tension.
It is the don'ts that are truly convicting, though, because they perfectly describe our default human behavior when we are uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Don't avoid the employee out of your own discomfort. We have all seen this. Someone is let go but has to finish out the week. Suddenly, the entire office treats them like a ghost. People stare at their phones when they pass them in the break.
It is a cowardly preservation tactic. We avoid them so we don't have to feel the guilt or the awkwardness.
And the curriculum forbids that.
Yeah.
It demands that you protect their dignity all the way to their car on their final day. Don't act like nothing changed. You know, you cannot be artificially chirpy.
Yeah, right. Don't pretend it's a normal Tuesday.
And my personal favorite, don't make jokes about the situation.
Oh, the nervous manager attempting to lighten the mood by saying, well, at least you finally get to work on your golf swing.
It is catastrophic to the person losing their livelihood. It minimizes their trauma to soothe your anxiety. The RT framework insists that if you must terminate employment, you do not have permission to terminate their dignity.
Absolutely.
So, listener, let's run a brief diagnostic on your own behavior. Conduct a mental audit of the words you have spoken in your workplace over the last 5 days. Are your words reliably functioning as tools of construction or weapons of demolition? Do you protect the dignity of the colleagues who frustrate you the most?
That audit requires brutal honesty, but we also have to acknowledge reality here. Even if an entire organization perfectly internalizes respectful communication, humans are inherently messy. Friction is inevitable. Fires will ignite.
Which brings us to the operational hazard of any workplace, which is conflict. We have discussed how Archie prevents the fire. Now we need to examine how they extinguish it.
That's right.
The conflict resolution module is fascinating because it shatters a very common, very damaging myth. Most HR departments, and certainly most churches, preach a monolithic approach to conflict. If you have a problem with someone, you must go speak to them directly. That is the only tool in the toolbox.
And that is so limiting.
It is. But the RT curriculum categorizes 6 distinct, valid methodologies for resolving conflict.
The recognition of multiple methodologies is what makes the program so robust. Let's outline the mechanisms of the 6 types.
Let's do it.
Type 1 is conviction of conscience. This is entirely internal. A person realizes their own error through reflection or spiritual conviction and corrects their behavior without anyone else intervening.
The operational advantage is that it involves the fewest people and 0 public embarrassment.
Exactly. The severe disadvantage, as the text notes, is that it is agonizingly slow. You are passively waiting for the offender to achieve self-awareness, which may never happen.
Yeah, you could be waiting decades for some people.
Mm-hmm.
So type 2 is outside correction. This occurs when an external party points out the blind spot. The biblical parallel used is the prophet Nathan confronting King David about his catastrophic moral failures.
But the module explicitly warns that in a corporate environment, this is highly dangerous due to the potential for retaliation.
Correct. Which leads to type 3, the most widely cited method, often referred to as direct correction or the Matthew 18 model. This is the mandate to bypass gossip and go directly and privately to the person who offended you to seek resolution.
Type 4 introduces leverage, intervention by an outsider. This is the mechanism where someone with significant social, positional, or relational capital inserts themselves into a dispute to advocate for the weaker party who cannot defend themselves.
I love that one. Then type 5 is the formal escalation. Oh. Appeal to a higher authority. When peer-to-peer negotiation fails, you bring in a manager or an HR mediator to issue a binding verdict.
And type 6 is one that corporate cultures often view as a failure, but the curriculum validates as a healthy option. Compromise and peaceful separation.
Like agreeing to disagree.
Yes. Two parties acknowledge they hold irreconcilable operational differences, and they agree to part ways amicably, much like the historical split between Paul and Barnabas.
Having 6 distinct tools allows the organization to apply the correct intervention to the specific pathology of the conflict. But I want to aggressively drill down into type 3.
The direct confrontation model.
Yes, that direct one-on-one confrontation model. Because this is where the RT curriculum demonstrates a staggering level of emotional intelligence regarding workplace power dynamics.
Oh, it really does.
There is a rigid dogma in many institutions that mandates direct confrontation. If you didn't talk to them first, you can't complain to HR. But the RT text argues that strictly enforcing that rule can actually victimize the vulnerable.
It is a profound critique of blind proceduralism. The curriculum utilizes a highly realistic scenario to illustrate the danger. Imagine a young, newly hired female teacher in her first month on the job.
Okay.
She observes a 20-year veteran male colleague engaging in highly inappropriate behavior. If the institutional policy mandates strict adherence to the direct confrontation model, forcing her to pull this veteran aside privately, it completely ignores the reality of social capital, seniority, and the potential for intimidation.
The power imbalance is massive. She is calculating the risk. I have been here for 3 weeks. He has relationships with the entire board. If I accuse him privately, he will deny it, brand me as a troublemaker, and actively destroy my career trajectory.
Right.
Forcing her into that room is administrative negligence.
The RT documentation addresses this with a striking principle. Reconciliation should not be hamstrung by the lack of maturity or spiritual resources available to the parties involved.
That is so powerful.
The text argues that the historical Jesus actually placed the burden of accountability disproportionately on the mature, specifically to protect the weak. If that young employee bypasses the veteran and goes directly to a trusted mature leader to report the behavior because she is terrified, she is not engaging in malicious gossip.
Yeah.
She is intelligently seeking safety and wisdom.
The text uses a brilliant phrase to describe the danger of rigid HR policies. It warns against straining out a gnat while swallowing a camel.
Yes.
Meaning if leadership forces a terrified junior employee to confront a senior abuser just so they perfectly follow the procedural rule of direct communication, that is straining the gnat. You are obsessing over a minor procedural detail while completely ignoring the catastrophic abuse of power occurring in your organization.
Which is swallowing the camel.
Exactly. The text literally calls that approach foolish and cruel. Seeing a document prioritize the psychological safety of the vulnerable over strict procedural adherence is a revelation.
It fundamentally redefines equitable leadership. It dictates that the heaviest lifting in conflict resolution must be done by those with the most positional and emotional strength.
That just makes so much sense.
But this naturally transitions us into an even more complex territory. We have dissected direct conflict between colleagues, but the RT program recognizes that organizational health isn't just threatened by interpersonal warfare. Often, the threat comes from the private, isolated decisions of a single employee.
This is the personal decisions shared impact module.
Mm.
And the analogy the curriculum uses here is so visceral, it immediately clarifies the concept.
Mm.
It is the analogy of the stub toe.
Ah, yes, the stub toe.
Let's walk through the biomechanics of this. You wake up in the middle of the night, you walk into the kitchen, and you violently stub your pinky toe on a chair.
Ouch.
Right. In that exact second, the physical trauma is isolated to 1 square inch of your body. The rest of you is perfectly healthy. But what happens over the next 48 hours?
You start to limp to protect the toe.
Yes. You shift your weight to the opposite leg. Because of that unnatural posture, your knee begins to strain. By the next day, your hip is thrown completely out of alignment. By day 3, your lower back is in agonizing pain.
Wow.
Your entire kinetic chain is compromised and prone to secondary injuries, all because the system was forced to compensate for one tiny, isolated, localized failure.
The curriculum seamlessly maps that physiological reality onto the organizational ecosystem. The theological metaphor used is the church as the body of Christ, where every part is interconnected.
Right.
but the organizational psychology application is identical, and employees' private choices are a myth when they operate within a community structure. The module provides a specific inventory of these choices.
What's on the list?
Hidden substance abuse, chronic tardiness, an unmanaged toxic attitude toward authority, reckless social media behavior, or even a chaotic, emotionally unfaithful personal life.
That is a broad spectrum.
It is. These private decisions systematically deplete that individual's focus, their emotional resilience, and their physical health.
And when that individual becomes depleted, they become the stubbed toe. The rest of the corporate body is immediately forced to limp.
Exactly. The kinetic chain of the team breaks down. Colleagues have to work late to pick up the slack for the team member who is chronically absent. Managers have to spend hours tiptoeing around the individual who is emotionally volatile due to personal drama.
The entire organization adopts a misaligned, defensive posture to compensate for one person's refusal to maintain their own health.
Yes.
But let me play the role of the modern, fiercely independent employee here. The immediate pushback to this entire module is, my autonomy is absolute. What I consume on my weekend, who I date, and how I manage my personal life is none of the company's business.
Right. As long as I clock in and hit my KPIs, HR has no jurisdiction over my private choices.
Exactly. How does the RT framework navigate this massive cultural friction between individual freedom and collective impact?
It deconstructs the modern illusion of absolute autonomy by examining the economics of community. The expert synthesis within the module forces the employee to confront a harsh reality. Perfect, unrestrained freedom cannot coexist with the benefits of a shared ecosystem.
That is a tough pill to swallow for a lot of people.
It is. The curriculum uses a powerful diagnostic exercise. It asks the participant to catalog all the tangible and intangible benefits they extract from being part of the organization. The list is extensive. Financial security, emotional support from colleagues, shared resources, access to mentorship, the ability to tackle larger problems collaboratively, networking, and the celebration of shared victories.
The ROI of community is undeniable. We are a social species. We need the herd to survive and thrive.
We do. But the curriculum presents the ultimate trade-off. You cannot demand access to the immense wealth of the community while simultaneously hoarding 100% of your personal autonomy.
Wow.
To gain entry into the safety of the group, you must surrender a fraction of your freedom. You surrender the freedom to show up whenever you want. You surrender the freedom to speak recklessly. You surrender the freedom to engage in habits that destroy your reliability.
Right.
If you demand absolute autonomy to make toxic, depleting choices, you categorically forfeit the right to demand that the rest of the community absorb the shockwaves of your consequences.
That reframes the entire disciplinary conversation. It elevates it from a punitive scolding, you know, you broke section 4 of the employee handbook, to a profound communal intervention. The message becomes, your choices are forcing this team to limp, and we care enough about you and the team to help you heal so we can all walk straight again.
It is so much more effective.
It treats maturity not as the ability to aggressively defend your rights, but as the capacity to recognize your responsibilities to the people sharing your oxygen.
Which leads us to the ultimate evaluation of this framework. We have dissected the internal mechanics, the roadmaps, the communication audits, the conflict resolution strategies, but we must zoom out to observe the macro impact. What happens to the broader ecosystem when a company replaces the PIP with the Rebuilding Together framework?
The source material outlines a ripple effect that is genuinely inspiring. The benefits cascade far beyond the HR filing cabinets. Let's look at the first demographic impacted, young employees.
Yes.
When you are early in your career, you lack historical perspective. A major mistake feels apocalyptic.
It feels like the end of the world.
Under a traditional system, an early failure often results in termination or severe marginalization, which breeds a permanent professional timidity. The RT framework entirely rewrites that narrative. It provides a highly structured, grace-filled laboratory where failure is expected and utilized.
Yeah.
It transforms what would have been a traumatic firing into rigorous career discipleship. It builds resilient professionals who know how to fail, take accountability, and recover.
And the second demographic is perhaps the most critical, yet the most ignored by corporate strategy. The families of the employees.
Oh, this is huge.
Consider the emotional physics of a traditional punitive disciplinary process. When an employee is placed on a PIP, they are plunged into a state of chronic existential dread. Their livelihood is threatened.
Yeah, they carry that terror, that cortisol, directly into their living room. They become short-tempered with their children. They experience friction with their spouse. the corporate punishment fractures the family unit.
But inject the RT program into that exact same crisis. The employees still made the severe mistake. But instead of being isolated and threatened, they are assigned a mentor. They are working through modules on emotional capacity and accepting responsibility. They are processing their failure through a lens of grace.
The psychological shift is profound. The workplace crisis, rather than destroying their home life, actually becomes a catalyst for accelerated emotional maturity.
Exactly. The employee learns advanced conflict resolution, emotional regulation, and deep accountability. And they export those newly acquired skills directly into their marriage and their parenting.
Which feeds directly into the final tier of the ripple effect, local communities. The documentation highlights that the RT program is essentially an intensive boot camp for emotional intelligence.
And decades of organizational psychology confirm that EQ, empathy, active listening, self-awareness is the ultimate predictor of long-term human flourishing.
It really is.
When an organization commits to rebuilding a fractured employee through this rigorous introspective process, they aren't just salvaging a spreadsheet analyst or a project manager. They are actively engineering a healthier human being.
Yeah.
That individual eventually leaves the office and participates in society. They sit on local volunteer boards. They coach Little League. They serve in their churches. Because of the RT intervention, they enter those communal spaces as better listeners, more empathetic leaders, and highly resilient citizens.
It transforms a corporation from a machine that extracts labor into an engine that generates societal health.
Exactly.
So I want to present a challenge to you, the listener. Visualize your current workplace. Look at the policies, the unwritten rules, and the way leadership handles failure. Is your organization treating people as disposable cogs, where the moment a part grinds or malfunctions, it is aggressively discarded and replaced? Or is there a mechanism in place that views employees as complex, inherently valuable people whose deliberate development could positively alter the trajectory of their families and communities for generations?
Shifting from the former to the latter requires immense courage from leadership.
It does. Let's trace the arc of what we have uncovered today. We started by confronting the bleak, punitive reality of the modern corporate disciplinary system. We explored the architecture of the Rebuilding Together program, the necessity of the signed intake form, the customized IEP-style modules, and the strategic brilliance of utilizing external mentors to neutralize office politics. We waded into the deep waters of communication, anchored by the conviction that we are never dealing with mere mortals. We examine the necessity of auditing our fears before managing upward, and the mandate to utilize clarity as kindness when managing downward.
Yeah, that clarity piece is so important.
We navigated the six distinct avenues of conflict resolution, recognizing the danger of forcing the vulnerable to carry the burden of direct confrontation. And finally, we confronted the reality of the stubbed toe, that our demand for absolute private autonomy cannot supersede our responsibility to the health of the community.
As we conclude this analysis, there is a final, subtle paradigm shift embedded in this philosophy that challenges the very vocabulary of modern business.
What is that?
Every major corporation houses a department titled Human Resources. If we pause and truly examine the linguistics of that title, the implication is deeply utilitarian.
Oh, totally.
A resource is a raw material. Timber is a resource. Coal is a resource. A resource exists solely to be extracted, aggressively utilized, consumed until its inherent value is entirely depleted, and then unceremoniously discarded.
Human resources.
Yeah.
We literally classify people in the exact same category as diesel fuel.
We do. But the Rebuilding Together framework demands a total linguistic and philosophical rewrite. What if we stripped human resources off the door and replaced it with human restoration?
Human restoration.
Even if your specific company never formally adopts the RT curriculum, You possess the individual agency to operate within its principles immediately. You have the authority to act as that safe, objective mentor for a younger colleague who is spiraling. You have the power to deploy clarity rather than ambiguity in your next team meeting.
Yeah.
When a colleague inevitably stumbles, you can choose to help them build their capacity rather than quietly helping management show them the door.
Human restoration. That is the fundamental choice at the heart of leadership. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. My hope is that you carry these mechanisms back to your own desk, because tomorrow or next week, a colleague is going to make a profound mistake. And when you find yourself standing at the crossroads holding a sterile PIP in one hand and the option for grace in the other, I hope you choose to hear the heart.
Thanks for joining us for another podcast. No matter what perspective you're coming from, we hope that Hear the Heart stirs your heart in some very good ways. We want to show how the teachings of Jesus are instructive for those who believe and inviting for those who don't. I hope we accomplished our mission with this week's Hear the Heart podcast.